The Chicago and your suburbs are very blue. And elsewhere in the state, it's very red. And the voters in the red region can't believe that they have little or no representation in the congressional delegations. Now, under Illinois Governor Pritzker's 2020 redistricting plan, the Democrats will gerrymander downstate, eliminating many of the Republican seats. Redistricting uses the latest technology going neighborhood by neighborhood to get just enough Democratic votes to knock out the Republican congressman. Will downstate Republicans revolt because they are denied representation?
Illinois is a great example of a state that's been gerrymandered by Democrats, and this is the second cycle in a row. New York Democrats just unveiled a pretty aggressive gerrymander in that state. Then you also have Republican gerrymanders in places like Texas, North Carolina, Ohio, and Florida. Now, one of the things that's happened in some of these states is that statewide ballot measures enact some sort of prohibition on gerrymandering or some sort of limit. And Democrats have proposed trying to do that at a federal level. The most recent big Democratic voting bill would set some standards in place that would sort of knock out districts that went too far. If you're a Republican in Illinois or a Democrat in Texas, you probably feel like the deck is stacked against you. You mentioned Illinois. There's one that goes from East St. Louis all the way to Champaign-Urbana. It's just a snake that picks up as many Democratic areas as possible in order to create a Democratic-leaning seat. Both sides end up doing it. I think what the difference has been in recent decades is that Republicans have had more power to do it than Democrats have. And that's why I think that Democrats have been more interested in some sort of federal solution or federal guidelines for redistricting.
Let's use Staten Island as an example.
Staten Island itself is not big enough to have a single House member, so it has to be connected to the rest of New York City. And under the current map, it's connected to places like Bay Ridge, more kind of conservative-leaning parts of Brooklyn. And then this map connects it instead to Park Slope and other parts of Brooklyn that are really pretty Democratic. Of the 40 most densely populated districts, the only one held by a Republican was New York 11, which is the Staten Island seat. You have this conservative Republican bastion in the midst of an otherwise very Democratic area, although it actually is possible, given that there are Republican pockets in Brooklyn, it would be possible to draw a Republican seat in those places too. One of the things about New York is that voters did actually create an independent redistricting commission. Clearly, the commission wasn't strong enough, so it was essentially sabotaged. Democrats didn't really want to play ball with it, and it didn't really produce any proposals. The Democrats in the state legislature, they now have 2/3 majorities in the state House and the state Senate, so they were able to pass their own plan. Democrats, for the first time in modern history, had unified power in New York, and they're using it. The state constitution in New York suggests some prohibitions on having districts that are not that compact. The Republicans could win a court case on this, although the Democrats control the court. There's a similar situation going on in Florida where the shoe's on the other foot, that the Republicans are the ones trying to gerrymander. There are prohibitions against gerrymandering written into the state constitution, but the court is very conservative. So will the court actually enforce the constitution or not?
Is there any advantage or bias that favors one of the political parties for U.S. House races? Biden won the presidential popular vote by 4 percentage points, and voters no longer split tickets. So why don't we see a larger Democratic majority in the House? Biden voters are highly concentrated in particular states like California, Massachusetts, New York, and Illinois, and the Republican voters are more diffuse. Is that the critical variable?
Population density issues that you raise are sort of a disadvantage for Democrats in the House. There's specifically a really good book that came out a couple years ago by Jonathan Rodden called Why Cities Lose. And he doesn't believe that the Democrats are sort of a natural geographic disadvantage everywhere, but he particularly thinks that they are in some of the old industrial states in the North, so like Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan. Even if you were drawing a fair map, the Republicans would still have an advantage because of overconcentration of Democratic voters in urban areas. There are significantly more kind of landslide Democratic presidential districts, you know, places where Joe Biden got 80 or 90% of the vote. If you're a Democrat, you could gerrymander those places and then extend them out to surrounding areas to try to make more Democratic seats. It's effectively what Democrats have tried to do in Illinois. Biden won the national popular vote. It's like 4.4, 4.5 points. The median House seat, if you just rank all the districts, Biden won by about 2 points. So the median House seat's about 2 points to the right of the nation.
Moving on. The 1965 Voting Rights Act concentrated African-American and Hispanic voters in these districts that are supercharged for the Democrats. And the Black Caucus was very happy to get these African-American congressmen. But on the national level, it hurts Democrats because they couldn't combine the African-American voters with the suburbs to create slim Democratic majorities. And then in 2010 in Illinois, for the first time since 1965, The Democrats decided to reapportion some of those African-American voters into the suburbs to flip suburban districts. Does the Voting Rights Act advantage the Republicans? Do you think the Democrats will undercut the Voting Rights Act to end African-American congressional representation to win more House seats? And do you think the Black caucus will agree to it?
The Voting Rights Act was changed in such a way in the early 1980s that sort of made it suggest that there was an interest that should push the creation of more majority-minority districts. And so one of the things that happened in the 90s, and this was a time where Democrats still had a lot of control of state government, but George H.W. Bush was president and the Justice Department decided to use its power to give preclearance to maps, particularly in the South. That doesn't really exist anymore based on Supreme Court decision from several years ago. But back then, the Justice Department said that you have to draw more majority-minority districts based on the Voting Rights Act. And so that had the effect of creating more districts that elected Black and Latino members in certain places to the House that ended up bleaching effectively the districts that surrounded those in the South to the point where it contributed to Republican seat flips. Back 30, 40 years ago, you'd think in order to elect a non-white member from a district, you need to have a majority non-white population. I don't think that's really true right now. And actually, Illinois 14 is a good example because Lauren Underwood is a Black Democrat, but that is a majority white district. The Trump-driven realignment, small town areas got much more Republican, but a lot of suburban places got much more Democratic, and that allowed the Democrats to achieve their goal in Illinois.
Split ticketing. When I was growing up, people would say they were independent, voted for the person, not the party, and then split their tickets. Does that even exist anymore? I recently perused the Almanac of American Politics that details each of the 435 congressional districts, and I was surprised how the voting patterns for the House elections and the presidential election in that district were virtually identical.
Gary Jacobson is one of the great congressional scholars, and he said that this was the strongest correlation between presidential and House results since 1952. There were 9 districts that Biden won, but a Republican won for House. And there were 7 districts that a Democrat won, but Trump won. And, you know, sometimes the differences are pretty minute. If you ask people their party ID, 35% say independent, 35% say Democratic, 30% say Republican. Gallup will ask people their leaned party identification. They'll ask the independents, hey, do you lean toward a party or not? And pretty quickly you get to 90% plus saying that they lean to one party or the other. I think a lot of those people who call themselves independents are effectively lying to people or they're lying to themselves because they generally do have a strong preference. If you go back to the 60s and 70s, Lyndon Johnson winning effectively 60-40 in 1964, and then 8 years later, you have Nixon winning 60-40. That's a lot of people changing their votes over time. Whereas now, Barack Obama winning by a little over 7 points in 2008 is like a landslide, and all the elections since 2000 have been closer than that. So you don't have as many people changing their minds in suburban districts, places that used to be pretty Republican. A lot of those places are becoming more Democratic, but the Democrats are kind of hollowing out in some old industrial centers and small towns and medium-sized cities, places like Youngstown and Warren, Ohio, or Wisconsin and Minnesota, sort of outside the big urban areas. Tom Davis, who's a former Republican congressman from Virginia, has this great way of saying that American voters have become parliamentary in their voting patterns, meaning that they really are voting for the party as opposed to the individual member. The value of incumbency is far reduced. There's less ticket splitting. And in some ways, that probably means you've got a fairly well-ordered set of policy priorities or things that you care about in politics. And it probably makes more sense for you to vote a straight ticket than it does to split your ticket. People just sort of digest politics more through a national lens, and that's led to the more nationalized voting patterns. Newt Gingrich, who I think is a really important figure, when he was toiling away in the minority, one of the things he really wanted to do was get these Republican voting presidential districts to vote for Republicans for the House. Well, all these different factors that have nationalized politics contributed to this lack of ticket splitting.
New Jersey voted for Biden over Trump by 16 points. And in the November 2021 governor's race, the Democrat won by only 1%. And then down ticket, the state senate president lost to an unknown candidate that spent like $1,500 on his entire campaign. What just happened in New Jersey?
The presidential election year is just a lot different than the off-year elections. It's very common for the presidential party that holds the White House to struggle in these elections. A party wins a majority with the presidential election, then they end up losing it 2 years later with this midterm backlash. The non-presidential party is sort of more motivated to show up. There are also swing voters who are upset for different reasons. Biden's numbers were bad. I've heard some analysis of voter file in New Jersey and sort of who came out to vote and who didn't. It was a combination of Republicans had disproportionately good turnout and also folks who may have voted for Biden in the past switched to voting Republican for governor. And there are more crossover party governors. Maryland and Virginia have Republican governors now, as does Vermont and Massachusetts. Those are all blue states. I think Virginia is still a blue-leaning state, despite the fact that Republicans won these most recent statewide elections last year. Republicans did 11 points better than they had done in 2017 in both governor's races. 2017 was a great Democratic environment. 2021 was a great Republican environment. 2022 is shaping up to be a good Republican environment nationally, although, you know, we've still got a lot of time until the midterm.
Larry Bartles, a Vanderbilt professor of political science, espouses the idea that when you switch political parties, you adopt the views of your new party. The best example he gives is Republicans who switched parties in 1974 because of Watergate also changed their view on abortion. Why do your political views change when you switch political parties?
The leaders of the party help set what people actually care about and believe in politics. And it shows that people's political views can be sort of malleable. So, like, let me give you a specific example. So the Democrats are trying to pass this Build Back Better package that has a number of different things in it. You can poll on those individual issues and often find a lot of support for them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that those people want the government to prioritize it. In fact, I think that Biden's problem and the Democrats' problem is that they're not seen as focusing on the stuff that people actually care about, be it getting past COVID or inflation, which used to be a big problem in American politics, hasn't been in recent years, but now is again. So there's a little bit of a disconnect there, I think.
Let's compare realignment in two House congressional districts. The first is the Illinois 10th, which includes Glencoe, where I grew up, versus the Ohio 13th, which includes Youngstown. Illinois 10 includes the wealthiest suburbs in the Midwest and is trending Democratic. When I was born, Donald Rumsfeld represented this district, and until Trump, it used to switch back and forth between the parties every 2 years. Ohio 13 is a working class community that was historically Democratic, and that's now trending Republican. What's going on here?
It's a great question, and you pick two good districts because one of the numbers that I really look at, particularly in the Trump era, that I think is almost always telling about where a district is going is what's the percentage of four-year college attainment? And Illinois 10 is very high. Ohio 13, which is Youngstown-Warren district, Obama won by 25 and historically been Democratic, and Biden only won it by 3 or 4 points. In the Illinois district, four-year college attainment is really high. In the Ohio district, four-year college attainment is pretty low. If you have a combination of substantial non-white population and a substantial highly educated population, those are going to be districts that zoom toward the Democrats in recent years, and white working class districts have zoomed toward the Republicans in Trump years.
Looking here at my almanac for American politics, in the Illinois 10, 56% are college or postgraduates, but in the Ohio 13th, it's only 24%. One of the interesting tidbits I learned from reading your book, Long Thread, was about Texas in the 60s. And the stat that really shocked me was the 1962 Texas congressional delegation had 24 Democrats and 0 Republicans. 24-0. How could Texas be that lopsided? I thought that the Republicans were players in Texas in the 60s.
I think it's more accurate to say it was conservative, not necessarily Republican, because, of course, Republicans had very little power in that state, although Kennedy barely won Texas in 1960. And look, there's some belief that there was shenanigans in South Texas.
Was there substantial voter fraud in the presidential election in Texas in 1960?
If you read the Robert Caro, Lyndon Johnson books, there's pretty good evidence that there was fraud in South Texas that maybe allowed Johnson to win the Senate and also Kennedy in 1960. Texas was effectively a one-party state. However, the Democratic delegation was filled with some of the most conservative members of the House. But over time, those conservative Democrats died off, became Republicans, et cetera, and the party sort of got more ideologically cohesive over time.
After the 1960 presidential election, Nixon was informed of the election irregularities in Texas and Illinois, but he chose not to escalate the matter. Why has this political norm changed? Biden mentioned in his recent press conference that he expects to see massive election fraud in the next midterm. How did challenging elections and voter fraud impact turnout?
I think anger can be kind of a motivator in the lead up to the Georgia runoffs. Had the effect of giving the Democrats a little bit of a turnout advantage in that election. However, there's also some belief later on throughout 2021 and into the Virginia election that the Republicans' feelings that the election was stolen was actually giving them motivation to vote, anger being a great motivator. And so I do think our elections are a lot cleaner than they were back then. it's not wrong for a candidate to allege there's some sort of problem if, in fact, they've got some evidence that there was a problem. It's just that what's been tricky about 2020 is I don't think that Trump has really produced good evidence in favor of his allegations. But North Carolina, there was a House race in 2018 where there was sufficient suggestion that there was fraud, that they actually did a do-over election. The results actually ended up being roughly the same. The Republicans very narrowly won both times.
What do you think partisan turnout will be in the midterms?
Republicans have something of a turnout advantage in these kinds of elections. There also is some broad dissatisfaction with Biden amongst certain Democratic groups that are already kind of lower turnout. Biden's numbers amongst the youngest voters are really pretty weak, even though the youngest voters is also generally the most Democratic demographic at this particular point. Biden has also seen declines in approval with non-white voters in general. Black voters still broadly approve his job performance, but not nearly as high as you'd expect for a Democrat. Latino, Asian American, et cetera, his numbers are low. And those groups don't have a high turnout propensity anyway. So there might be some folks who just are dissatisfied with Biden and decide not to show up. In terms of the Georgia example, turnout in the runoffs, I think overall was extremely high. It was within range of presidential level turnout. It may have been that Trump's antics after the election had more of a mobilizing effect on Democrats than it had a demobilizing effect on Republicans. But with Trump not on the scene anymore, I think it's harder for Democrats to use Trump as a foil for turnout.
In your book, you discuss midterms of the past. Unpopular present parties have lost 40 to 60 House seats during midterms. But today, due to the redistricting process, there are so few competitive seats. I mean, a 5-point national shift will not flip that many seats.
There certainly were a lot of landslide seats in past generations, too. Now, I will say that there are fewer competitive seats than there used to be. Also, I think this really stands out at sort of the statewide level in that there are less competitive states in the Electoral College than there used to be. Years like 1960 and 1976, you had dozens of states where the presidential vote looked very similar to the national vote. A lot of the big states, you know, Texas, California, New York, Florida, were all competitive. And, you know, there's still competitive states now, but there are many more that are landslide states. You do still have big swings in the House. I mean, you know, the Republicans picked up 60 seats in 2010. The Democrats picked up 40 in 2018. Even if the Republicans have a really big year in 2022, the sort of raw number of net gains won't be as big because they already have 213 seats. Back in 2010, they only were in the 170s, so they had more seats to gain. I wrote something recently for our Crystal Ball newsletter sort of speculating, like, could the Republicans get to their biggest House majority since the Great Depression, which would be 248 seats? That would be a 35-seat net gain. That would be a huge landslide, even though the net gain would still be less than in previous years just because they're starting from a higher point, although the Democrats have been drawing a lot of seats that are Biden plus 8 or plus 9 or something. So Democratic leaning, but not overwhelmingly so. If the Republicans are going to have a big election, those are the seats they would need to flip.
In perusing the Almanac of American Politics, which, by the way, is a must for political junkies like me, you can see that there's little to no Republican flip opportunities in the South. All the opportunities are in the Mid-Atlantic, Northeast, and Midwest. These are where Biden won districts by just a few points.
The South is historically not very competitive because it was either really strongly Democratic or really strongly Republican. Now, in many of those places, you have like a deep blue Democratic district surrounded by a bunch of really Republican districts. You know, the Midwest historically is the most competitive region in American politics. There are districts in Michigan and Pennsylvania that are not as Democratic as they used to be. When there have been waves, you feel it a little bit more in the Midwest in particular, just because the region is broadly pretty competitive.
What are your current predictions for the 2022 midterms?
If the conditions that we had in November for Virginia and New Jersey are still in place, you definitely expect the Republicans to win both the House and the Senate. That's sort of my default position right now, just because Biden's numbers have been weak for the past several months and they're not showing any signs of getting better. And I do think that the Biden approval number is the most important number in looking at these elections. The Republicans only have four real targets in the Senate, and I wouldn't pick them to win all of them at this point, but you'd probably expect them to get two or three. And in the House, probably somewhere in the 20s in terms of a net gain. We'll put them basically in the 230s in terms of total seats, which is a decent-sized majority, but not so big that the Democrats couldn't flip it back in 2024.
The Republicans have to defend Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Do you think they're at risk of losing either of those Senate seats?
In a year like this, you'd expect the Republicans to be able to hold on to those seats in states that are very competitive. If Trump were still in the White House, I'd probably be saying the Democrats have a great chance to flip both Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, but the fact of Biden being in the White House changes the dynamic. And you've got Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada, Democratic seats that Biden won. Nevada was 2.5 points, and Georgia and Arizona were less than a point, so it wouldn't take much.
The big story of the 2020 election was changes in the political party preferences for the Hispanic voter. Arizona and Nevada have a substantial number of Hispanic voters. Is there a Hispanic realignment going on?
There are polling indications that the Democratic problems with working class voters of all stripes are continuing. Think about a state like Nevada that has been narrowly Democratic in the last few elections. I mentioned the importance of white college-educated suburbanites in places. I mean, yes, those voters exist in Nevada, but Nevada doesn't have super affluent, highly educated suburban areas like Metro Atlanta or Northern Virginia or Minneapolis, St. Paul, et cetera. Nevada is more of a working-class state. You could see a further erosion for Democrats amongst Latinos and Asian American voters, at least in the context of 2022. And that is really important in a lot of these districts and states. And again, Nevada and Arizona top the list. Arizona does have a lot of Democratic trending suburban places around Phoenix. And that's part of the reason why Biden was able to win the state.
Do you think Republicans benefit by replacing Trump with DeSantis at the top of the ticket?
If the Republicans had a new nominee in 2024, that would actually be a great thing for the party because they could keep some of the Trump Republicans in the party who have become so alienated from the Democratic Party that they'll vote for basically any Republican now. And then you also have a friendlier voice to appeal to some of the people who the party has lost.
What if the Republicans were a moderate like Nikki Haley?
My guess is that there would be some fall off from the people who love Trump more than they love the Republican Party. And there are polls about this. You ask people, do you identify more with Trump or more with the Republican Party? And Trump is the higher number.
The white female suburban voter in the Midwest, Mid-Atlantic, and Northeast were anti-Trump, and those districts swung Democratic. If Nikki Haley were top of the ticket, would that affect the female suburban white voter?
I think we can sometimes overstate the importance of identity politics, be it with gender or race or what have you. My guess is that it wouldn't have that big of an effect.
What is more important, the politician or the policies?
I think it's more party than person.
What do you mean by that?
There's a dynamic in American politics called negative partisanship, which means that there are some people who want to vote more against the other party than for their own.
I end each session on a note of optimism. Kyle, what are you optimistic about?
I don't think gerrymandering is the be-all and end-all of politics in the House the way that I think some people do. I do think that there are encouraging signs that there are reform efforts going on that might dull the impact of the practice. The number of states that are using commissions or otherwise sort of imposing some sort of standards on redistricting to take the edge off gerrymandering, that's sort of increasing. And so I think that that's probably a positive House story. Again, just limited to the House.
Kyle, thank you so much.
Thank you.